Chris Iosaitis is my latest guest. In this series of nostalgia interviews, we conducted this interview in southern Scotland. Chris teaches religious, moral and philosophical studies in a North Lanarkshire secondary school. He previously did his PhD in a similar area to me, in religion and film. That's how we met, actually, about 20 years ago at a British Association in the Study of Religion conference. Chris did his PhD at the University of Stirling. Chris grew up in West London in the 1960s. He talks about his family being refugees from Poland. He remembers watching England win the World Cup in 1966. He also remembers the Kennedy assassination and the particular impact that it had on him. He talks about the freedom of growing up and his memory of travelling by himself on the tube at the age of 11 to see a football match. And he talks about how the Second World War was an unspoken shadow looming over the lives of his family. He remembers Saturday morning pictures at the ABC Hammersmith and why cinema going wasn't an escapist endeavour. He recalls being impressed by Roy Orbison's Oh Pretty Woman and how he once got to meet Ray Davis and once came close to seeing the Big O on stage. It was an essay on spaghetti westerns that secured Chris's passage into university. He runs a film club with his school children. He talks about why he shows Pleasantville each year to his school children and the pleasure he gets from watching their reaction to it. We find out why he has a problem with the word deserve, the importance of resilience, why adulthood is about accepting compromises, why teaching is a noble profession, why we need to take responsibility for our actions, why nostalgia worries Chris because it can seem more attractive than the painful present to which we cannot go back. And at the end of the interview, we discover whether Chris is a looking back or a looking forward type of person. So my name is Chris DC. Join me for the latest in my nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Chris Iosaitis. Okay, well, I'm in Stirling this evening, and it's great to meet Chris Iosaitis, who I knew, we were just talking before we started recording, about 15, 20 years ago, when you were doing your PhD in Stirling.
On religion and film.
Yeah, I remember John Ford and Cavalry Films.
Oh, that's right, yeah, I did some stuff on John Ford, the early... There was the big train movie about the building the railroad, just a way into looking at sort of religion and American national identity as it was kind of articulated in the cinema stuff. But those are different times, I think. Yeah. Different times.
No, and I remember meeting you at a conference and you were telling me all the films you were watching, and I thought, I haven't seen any of these. And, you know, and then, of course, it was that paranoia, which I used to get on buses sometimes when people would say to me, when I said I was looking at religion and film, they'd say, which biblical epics are you watching? And I was like, well, that's not quite what I'm doing. Yeah, but in a way, I thought, wow.
No, it's exactly my view. I mean, it's sort of, what's the connection? And I say, what about story, culture, society, you know, those kinds of things.
Well, we're probably good. My Darling Clementine.
There's a fantastic, still one of my favourite scenes in American cinema is there's a dance... in a half-built church in Tombstone, and I forget the actor's name offhand, but he plays. He's not really a preacher, and he says he's read the good book from cover to cover and back again, and he's seen nary a word again dancing. So he proposed that we have a damn good dance. As an astonishing scene. Really, it's really great. It's the sort of thing that could get you quite obsessed about. Yeah. Sort of that angle of American cinema.
Well, who knows? In post Brexit times, maybe that's exactly what we should be doing.
Dancing in churches. In Scotland, you need to put a roof on it. There's no roof on that one.
That's great, but that's not what you're doing now, is it?
No, I'm a school teacher now. I teach religious, moral, philosophical studies in Greenfolds High School, which is in Cumbernauld, which anybody that has ever seen the movie Gregory's Girl...
I have indeed.
Well, Cumbernauld features heavily in that. And the old Greenfolds High School, we moved about 2 years ago. The old Greenfolds High School actually features in that, though it's not the main one. There's a school called Abram Hill, which actually has also disappeared, shall we say. If you know that, that's the town. So for in Cumbernauld terms, I'm quite an exotic creature. Doctor Yazai, as I'm known there. I had a bit of something different maybe to the lives of kids in Cumbernauld, so that's what I do now.
Fantastic. But let's go back a little bit further then to how things began, because you certainly don't sound like you're from Cumbernauld.
So I'm not from around here.
Same way that I don't sound, well, I actually probably sound more like I'm from Kent, which I'm certainly not, than from Cardiff, which is where I am from. But where were you born?
I was born in a place called Farnham Common, which is between Slough and Beaconsfield in the sort of the hinterland of London, maybe 25 miles outside of London. Born in a nursing home, which is now a block of flats. And apparently, so I'm reliably informed by my mother, and as Lou Reed said, you can't trust your mother. I broke the record for being the biggest baby born there. This was back in the days of rationing, 1958, and I topped the 10-pound mark, which was going a bit. And I was a bit early as well, so she was probably quite relieved to get rid of me.
Well, my children were early, but they were, the biggest was 5, I think, 15.
Okay.
Yeah. You were a very big baby.
Unfortunately for my wife... as she is now, though not when she had my sons, they both came out big. She says, "You could have told me you were that big."
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. But all my children were born prematurely. And I got twins who were actually born at 31 weeks and 6 days, and they were
The wonders of modern medical science.
So no, you're right. And
that would have been quite stressful.
Yeah, back in the 50s, you wouldn't have had that technology.
No, they would have. It's not happening. Try again.
But what about earliest memories? What can you remember growing up around the
Well, I remember. I remember. I mean, I remember moving around a lot. Actually, we moved around quite a lot when I was young. But to put it into context, both my parents were sort of came over shortly after the war, and they were teenagers probably when they came over, about 1948, and they both ended up living sort of not far from where I was born. There were some refugee camps for Poles. And they met over here because, again, a bit like now, if you're an immigrant, if you're a refugee, your first point of contact is likely to be people like yourself. And so Poles tended often married other Poles then. And my mum and dad got married, and one day short of exactly 9 months after they got married, I came into the world. And we moved around a lot. We moved in Paddington, Streatham in London, and then we moved down to Brighton and Hove. And we moved in a couple of places, and then just as the memory starts to really stick when you start getting a story. You start going to primary school. I lived in Chiswick, and I think. That period from about 1965 to I think it was about 1971-72 when I lived in Chiswick and made the transition from primary school into secondary school. I still regard that as kind of a real kind of sort of a key moment. So there's all the sorts of things like I can actually remember watching England win the World Cup in 1966 on the telly. For me, just a sense, I actually remember the Beatles happening in the early 60s. I can remember the Kennedy assassination as well, because I could, that was what, 63, so it would have been about 5 then. And it was how upset my mum was. See, that was the connection. It wasn't so I didn't know who the hell JFK was. But these kind of sort of big moments, and of course these things are reinforced, I think, as you grow up, you realise, wow, that was quite important, wasn't it? You know,
or well, one of my previous interviewees also remembers the Kennedy assassination, but it was in the same week as the first Doctor Who episode. Okay. So he was talking about watching Doctor Who with William Hartnell in 1963. And you know, these are Goldust moments, because in a lot of cases, some of those earlier programmes were wiped out. You know, it's not the BBC didn't keep a recording of everything that was broadcast.
In terms of TV, I think the things that really made an impression on me were the Gerry Anderson animations. And I've got a vague recollection, and again, you don't know how much is this, because, you know, you occasionally see wee snippets on the TV of Supercar, but Fireball XL5 made a big impression. And I seem to remember getting a comic related to that. And then Stingray was a big deal, and then of course the best one of all, with Thunderbirds. So the 60s, I guess you got, it was a really very sort of real time of sort of optimism, I think. That's my impression. And, you know, coming with being the son of refugees, essentially, immigrant family, a sense of, you know, kind of things getting better for everybody. My family knew some really hard times, so my sense of my grandmother was really important. But my grandmother in particular did quite well for herself, and it was this sense of appreciating the fact that the good times are here, because they'd known, these are people who knew what it was like to really be wondering where your next food is coming from.
Was your grandmother in this country as well?
Yeah, she came over, and she was really the linchpin of our family. My grandfather on my dad's side, this was on my dad's side, died the year before I was born, shortly before my parents got married. And the shadow you really grew up with then, and I didn't really appreciate it until later, was the Second World War, which seemed impossibly distant to when you're small. And great TV memory at the time is it Brian Inglis, All Our Yesterdays, which it was every week, it was a half hour show, basically what happened 25 years ago. Was it 25? It would have been 25 years ago. Yeah, it would have been 25 years ago.
30, yeah.
So the remembering watching that stuff, essentially the history of the war, and because of the movies at the time, the stuff that you saw, and what kids played, the Second World War was this unspoken shadow. Or context. I don't know about a shadow, because I think people just kind of thought, thank goodness that's over.
Because I remember growing up, I was born in the early to mid 70s, but I remember on the 50th anniversary of the outbreak of the Second World War, with Sue Lawley on the BBC, they ran a series of programmes in real time. So it was sort of, the news from 1939, presented today, but in some cases with the same correspondent, like Charles Wheeler, mm-hmm. who was a journalist in the Second World mm-hmm. War, a very young mm-hmm. journalist, but was still working, and he must have been well into his 70s, if not more than that, in 1989. And that made a real impression on me, because it was using the sort of journalistic, almost like finesse, it was the sort of the conventions that we are used to now mm-hmm. in terms of communicating a narrative, but referring to something that was 50 years earlier, but it made it accessible to a generation like myself. And I also remember that coincided with Hillsborough, if I recall correctly. So it was that peculiar juxtaposition of two very different tragedies taking very different forms, but somehow coalescing in terms of the way that the news media, in a day before social media, was a way of...
Yeah, it's easy to forget. Yeah, I mean, these days, people sort of take that for granted, but, this kind of overarching narrative that often, particularly the BBC in Britain provided. It's interesting thinking about it. I can remember, later on in the 70s, I was growing up and I developed a sort of unhealthy obsession with music. And at one point, I was a big fan of the Who, and I remember reading fairly recently. By that I mean 20 years ago, an interview with Pete Townsend, when he was talking about My Generation, which is one of sort of the iconic songs of the mid 60s. And he says when he hears that, he just hears bomb damage, You know, because I mean, he came with a generation that were literally born out of the rubble of the Blitz and all that. And it's strange thinking back. I think about this quite a lot. The context that war provided really spurred my parents and grandparents' generation to, if you like, try and make life as sweet and as pleasant as possible. And of course, what do young people want? They want things to be exciting. There's always a bit of a tension, and also that's why that sort of generation gap, as it was called, grew up. Because when you read what life was like in the 50s, you know, when the teenagers came along, and then, you know, in the 60s, you know, the mods and the explosion of subcultures, they're looking for much more excitement than probably the people who survived the war were looking for. But at the same time, people appreciated, you know, there was, you know, the 60s, time of full employment, the greatest period of social mobility ever in our country's history. That context, people don't really appreciate the context that it provided, which enabled things like the things I subsequently became interested in, like the music, the counterculture, the movies. It made, you know, the culture moved away from just surviving. You know, I was brought up by people who knew who, you know, another day was going to be a bonus. It was a bonus at some points in their lives. To, you know, oh, we can buy a new fridge. You know, these kinds of things. So it's quite a sort of, it's quite a shift that people, I think, one of the things I do with my job now is I tell kids about things like queuing for a phone box. And you've got to understand that in my lifetime, things change so much that, you know, that is unrecognizable. They wouldn't be, you know, the kids I teach wouldn't be able to function in the world that I grew up in. Well, they certainly wouldn't see it as the good time that I saw it as well, because they'd see is the loss. Whereas actually, you know, I had an incredible amount of freedom growing up in West London in the 1960s. You went to school, you went home, you had a quick bite to eat, and you went out. And depending on what time of year it was, you were told what time you'd be to be getting back home. Inevitably, you'd be 10 or 15 minutes late. But you just went out and played with your pals, and whether it was sport or reenacting the war or a movie you've just seen or whatever, you had an incredible level of freedom. And, you know, for example, now I don't think, I developed, again, an unhealthy love of football in the late 60s. I started going to, just while we're on this, I did go, my first proper football match was a game, it was Fulham versus Manchester United, short tube right from where we're staying in Chiswick, and I can claim I saw Beslaw and Charlton play together, and they stuffed Fulham 4-0. It was an Easter, I think it might have been a Good Friday game, but he took me to Stamford Bridge a couple of times, and that was sort of ended up being, I started going on my own in 1969, and I'm thinking, I was 11, I'm going with me and my pals. I mean, most 11-year-olds certainly wouldn't be allowed anywhere near a, you know, this is when Stamford Bridge was getting maybe, I don't know, 40,000 gates standing. It was cheap. You could get in on your pocket money. But just an incredible level of freedom travelling about on the tube. And I think that's kind of something maybe that's been lost.
I think I was 21 when I went to the cinema on my own for the first time. I've been to the cinema before, but absurd. Yeah, because now I've made up for it.
I'll tell you a story about going to the cinema. Well, not quite on my own. I'm thinking this would have been 1968. And I would have been given some money for my birthday, so I would have been 10. My sister Barbara, she was, and if she listens to this, she's now known as Bashenka, but I'll call you Barbara. She would have been 5, okay, and we had one more sister at home, Alicia, who would have been two then. And I had some money. And my dad had taken me to Piccadilly Circus before and taken me to the news cinemas that used to... Basically, it was a kid's dream. Rolling cartoons and newsreels, which was still going around. And I thought, I'd really like to do that. So I took my sister to Piccadilly Circus. She was 5, I was 10. On the tube from Gunnersbury Station, Piccadilly Circus, went to the cinema, paid in, came back, went back on the tube. And we're walking back from the station. And obviously I've got an inkling that maybe we shouldn't have done this. Not certainly not without telling my mother. And of course, if I told my mother, it wouldn't have happened. I said, right, whatever you do, don't tell Mum what we've done. And this sort of defines my sister's relationship with me anyway. We get to the front door, go in. Mum, guess where we've been? I was in a lot of trouble.
Can you remember? I was going to say, can you remember what you saw that evening?
There would have been a Tom and Jerry cartoon. Probably something like the Road Run or something, one of the Looney Tunes stuff. I mean, it's just cartoons, really. It was, you know, it was all shorts. The sort of thing that people did when they're filling in time, really. It was inexpensive. You went, you saw a newsreel, and it would be just a cartoon. And if you stayed more than about an hour, you'd probably see the same newsreel.
But my mum used to tell me that she'd go to the cinema, and you would just arrive whenever, and you would just go in, and you'd be halfway through the film when you arrived. Uh-huh. Film would finish, it would start up again, and you would just sit through till you reached the point where you had earlier walked out. I mean, that's almost like how Tarantino makes his films, isn't it? You know, chronologically, yeah, all over the place. But when Hitchcock made Psycho, mm-hmm. I think I'm right in saying that there was a clear stipulation that anybody who arrived after the film had started was, you know, well, not allowed to enter the auditorium because, of course, of the way, without giving it away,
spoiler alert, yeah,
60 years on. But yeah, but that, you know, but it's so different now when everything is so corporate. You know, go to the cinema and you clearly arrive at a certain point and you have the 25 minutes of the trailers.
Well, it's more of that. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, you know, I think just the corporate is just means that they've just got better at it. I think that, you know, I mean, the cinema as it was, they were still run by big studios. I mean, Tom and Jerry's what, Warner Brothers?
MGM,
yeah. That's right, yeah, MGM. So those things were always there. I think, you know, they're obviously sort of consolidated and they're big conglomerates now and the rest of it. But also, you know, remember going to Saturday Morning Pictures at the ABC in Hammersmith, actually, was those things. You know, that's where the adults left you at the door because, I mean, I don't know how I would have coped, but it's the equivalent now of... there wasn't much in the way of TV on a Saturday morning for kids. And, of course, that's when parents like to, you know, maybe have a little bit of time, tidy the house, do a bit of shopping or whatever. So, you know, it kind of made sense. But, yeah, so, growing up in London in the 60s was pretty... a lot of fun, actually. It was a good time. And for my family, up until the end of the 60s, when things started getting a bit tricky financially... things seemed to be getting better. And of course, when you were, you know, I had the best of, for example, my family's relationship with my dad, for example. By the time my sisters were a bit older, there was a few issues. My dad had sort of gambling problems, shall we say, and it really started to have a really negative impact on our lives the older we got. So I'm not a great fan of the horse racing, shall we say. Mm.
But was cinema then a form of escapism? So I've got another friend who often talks about how she was going through her parents were going through a divorce, and so when she was spending time with her father, it was, you know, she associates that with going to the cinema, and he'd fall asleep, and then her love of movies came through that experience. It was almost like out of adversity came an opportunity, which has stuck with her 40 years on.
For me, it's not really escapism. I mean, my dad took me to the cinema a lot. I mean, he took me to see 2001 in the cinema. I mean, understood it at the age of 9, it probably would have been when it came out, 68. And that was in 70 mil as well. But I remember being taken to see, you know, the James Bond movies and that. And it wasn't escapism, it's just what people did. It was going to the cinema was central to the culture because TV was rubbish, basically. It certainly in terms of the quality. You can make an argument that, you know, there was good things going on in the on the TV, but if you wanted to be have your socks blown off, you went to the cinema. And the one thing I will say again is sort of, if you my dad, because he was a bit of a film obsessive, you know, like I say, I probably got the best out of my dad out of you know my sisters and myself. I became a bit of a film buff because of him. You know, and at the time, households would have, an ordinary household would have had just one TV. There was maybe three channels. I mean, we still had a black and white TV up until the early 70s. But my dad would see there'd be some obscure French film, which turned out later on, I'd go, oh, well, that's a classic, isn't it? And he'd want to watch that stuff. And so you'd watch it because you want to spend maybe a bit of time with dad, but you also wanted to watch TV. And so I was introduced to kind of quite sophisticated movies at an early age. So for me, that sort of love of film and a kind of understanding there's more to it than just kind of entertainment, if you like, kind of started quite early. There's a sort of historical sense, and again the same with music. My dad both my mum and dad were into music. My dad was, you know, he had old reel-to-reel tapes and stuff like that.
I remember
that.
Those in the early 80s,
and he'd put, you know, record stuff off the radio, and then he'd put, I mean, this was quite laborious for the time, if you like, the equivalent of mixtapes. He'd compile stuff that he'd got. Sometimes he'd go to the local library, he could borrow gramophones and put those things together. So I was really introduced to a really wide range of music as well. I mean, you know, again, that's why I was aware of the Beatles. But I was also introduced to, you know, the, you know, some obvious stuff like, I don't know, Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, and maybe stuff that I wasn't so keen on, you know. I mean, I think Jim Reeves to a sort of 5-year-old was a hard sell, but my mum liked Jim Reeves, and I was trying to figure out what was it about Jim Reeves. Do remember being really, really impressed early on by Roy Orbison, Oh Pretty Woman, which came out about 64, and remember being going for a Sunday drive. Remember those? You know, it was a big deal. You had time off, you took the car for a drive, going for a Sunday drive, and it came on the radio, and I was like, what is that? That's fantastic. And it still ticks all the boxes for me when I hear that. I was thinking, what a record.
I actually went to see Roy Orbison's hologram.
Okay.
in London a couple of months ago.
Wow, how was
that?
And
it was peculiar because he was kind of looking at the other members of the band, and he was acknowledging the audience, but of course it was all
fake,
digital. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And apparently, I was reading a review in one of the other screenings around the country. Somebody had shouted out "Encore, encore!" because that wasn't going to happen. But it was the actual voice.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, you could see through him. It took some adjusting to, but I guess it was the closest I'm ever going to get to, you know, seeing Buddy Holly, Roy Orbison live, because he was 52 when he died, and I was in school. I remember actually coming home from school and hearing on the news, it was the 4 o'clock news on Radio Wales, the lead story was that Roy Orbison had passed away, and it was just around the time that the Travelling Wilburys had been formed.
Well, that's right. I mean, I almost saw him, actually. I'm really, again, Roy Orbison's star had faded considerably. I mean, this would have been what? So this would have around about sort of mid to late 80s. And a brother of a former girlfriend of mine said, I'm going to see Roy Orbison tonight at the Mean Fiddler in Harleston. You want to come? Roy Orbison? I mean, almost a harbinger of that whole kind of, you know, heritage industry that bands, you know, is thriving now in terms of music. But he went, and I saw him, what was he like? I said, he was fantastic. He said he's a unique guitar style because of his kind of background in rockabilly. And it was just after that. I mean, the Mean Fiddler in Harleston's pretty small venue, sort of 500, 600 capacity, something like that. And then that led into this kind of big revival that he really enjoyed. A beautiful swan song to her. It's completely deserved, and you know, he sort of found a new audience. But I can still actually remember where we were. We were driving down by the docks in Brighton or Worthing, and this music came out of the car, and that was I think the first time I was really kind of, you know, wow, there's something special. I was aware that, you know, there's always music, and see, and the Beatles were such a big deal, but that was something that was just, you kind of think, wow, that's pretty cool.
And the same way with Only the Lonely, where the Everly Brothers, of course, appear at the beginning.
Uh-huh.
That you know, made a real impression as well, because, you know, Roy Orbison and the Everly Brothers.
Yeah, I've got a strange taste for the later Everly Brothers when they're trying to react to the Beatles. And because I'm a guitar player, the guitar playing on some of their records, because their early stuff, the big hits, actually, it's largely sort of strummed acoustic guitar, quite rhythmic and great. I mean, don't get me wrong, those are fantastic records, but I kind of like the oddball stuff. And there was a brilliant cover of Gone, Gone, Gone that Alison Krauss and Robert Plant did. And then again, that's from that sort of later period. And it's something, in some ways, because you're that familiar with the Everly Brothers stuff, that it's quite nice to explore the other stuff.
Well, I think one of their greatest songs is Unknown. It barely charted. It was in 1984, I believe, and it was On the Wings of a Nightingale. Okay. And of course, at that point, they'd fallen out with each other, as they did them many times. And I remember watching a documentary about them around the time that one of them, you know, passed away. And it was that you would never be, you know, whoever was friends with Phil wouldn't be friends with his brother. And, you know, they were very, very different, except come together, the harmonies were second to none. Mm-hmm. So in the early 80s, they'd obviously... I think what was powerful about that number was that they had a life story, that they'd been together, they'd fallen apart, but they did come back, and it was as beautiful as ever. And it was a sense of, we may never get this back again. So,
it was that famous concert at the Albert Hall, isn't it, when they sort of hadn't performed in Britain together for quite a long time. It's kind of strange, that sort of falling out with family stuff. But the singing duos, apparently Sam and Dave, the great soul singers, basically never spoke to each other once they left the stage.
And the Kinks, of course.
Talking of which, you bring up, so that was recently was recording in the Kinks studio in Muswell Hill, and I'm claiming I met Ray Davis. He said hello to me, and I said hello back. So I reckon I've met Ray Davis.
Or Sir Ray, of course. Who would have thought that in the
1960s? Well,
But what then inspired you? You sort of already indicated that film played an instrumental role in your life growing up, and you know, through your dad's obsession as well. But you undertook the PhD. Where did you think that was going to lead? And, you know, what was your motivation for doing that?
Well, I mean, that was a long, circuitous route to even get there. I'm not sure how much of a plan there was to do, because, I mean, there's a big gap between, say, you know, I mean, I went to university much later. And when I got to Stirling University when I was early 30s. Early 30s. And it was this, I'd been working in a record shop, second-hand record shop in London. And it was okay, the money was right, but you're living in London, but not really enjoying London. You're just working, going to the pub, working. And I thought, I think it's time I finished my education. And I'd sort of started doing classes at a place called the City Lit in London, acting classes, some art, and just getting back into, I'd hit a, sort of working backwards here, it's a bit like the Memento movie, where you sort of, you're like, well, what happened before then? I'd been playing in bands, and essentially my life had revolved around bands in my early mid-20s. And I got to a stage where, I remember thinking, I'm really sick of hanging around with people who are basically cartoon characters. also physically, you know, rock and roll lifestyle, all that stuff, I was just ready to do something different. So I started thinking, I'd quite like to learn. Gave up smoking, which is probably the smartest thing I've ever done, kids. And started sort of, you know, nurture, if you like, a kind of self-nurture, started learning. And I went to an introductory unit, which was a unit of first year undergrad course at Birkbeck College on introducing film and television. Because I thought, well, if I want to go to university, I need to show I can work at university level. And I got, and it, by the time I decided, strangely enough, it was entirely sort of serendipitous, because by the time I decided I wanted to go back into education or at a serious level, all the access courses had been full, and you know, but I could get onto that. And I thought, okay, let's see how I get on with this. And I absolutely loved it. First of all, you learn that actually the level you're working at, your writing and all that, isn't quite the level you think it is. You're kind of a bit disappointed by, you know, getting a, I don't know, 60% or something. Oh, I thought it was a bit better than that. But you learn, but it is also actually, you're introduced to a whole world of thinking much more deeply about the stuff that you engage with on a daily basis, you know, TV, film, and stuff like that. And go, who knew there was so much going on, really? And getting through that, and by the end, I wrote the essay, really, as I say, that got me into university, was an essay on spaghetti westerns, which is a pretty cool thing anyway. But I decided to apply, and I wanted to get out of London. I didn't apply to any universities within 100 miles of London, and Stirling had the most academic, and I think that's what I didn't want to do, a practical course. I wanted to read books and write essays and all that kind of very old fashioned stuff, I guess now. And Stirling came up, for an interview, travelled up by train, stayed in a B&B on the street where I currently live, went for the interview, and I knew I had a chance because I walked in and Mike, who ended up being my supervisor, had a poster for Mean Streets on the wall of his study, and being a big Scorsese fan, I even put Scorsese in my application saying, you know, I really like films of Martin Scorsese, blah blah blah. I got the gig, so I got the place, came up, and at Stirling, what was interesting about Stirling was you could do units in other areas. You had to sort of, you know, try a few things out.
And wild modules.
Yeah, I mean, film and media, I didn't realise I got in. It was actually a really sought after course. It was pretty much, it was one of the first serious film studies, film and media studies places in Britain, especially the academic thing, and they had some sort of quite big names. And when I told people I got a place, some of the people I worked with were really impressed. They'd heard of some of the people that I was going to be studying with. But you had to, and they did, there was education, there was history, religious studies. I thought, oh, I had always read, it, I was interested in, you know, reading up on religion. I've been brought up in the Church of Rome, always good for a filmmaker, I think. That's always a plus. Decided that I'd give that a go, and I fell in love with it. It was such an interesting, Stirling University then, in the early 90s. Richard King, your colleague, was just starting his career then. Keith Wylam, who's an Old Testament scholar, who his first lecture was all quoting from, actually, Turn, 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 the book of Ecclesiastes, the birds. And I was sitting with an old hippie called Scott, who I'm still friends with. And of course, we recognised the lyrics he was quoting, and ended up doing a degree which was 60% film and media studies and 40% religious studies. And I met a lot of really, really... The religious studies department was a really inspiring place to be. Lots of really brilliant people came into the part. They expanded. It became really, really popular. There was three people in it to begin with. I think there was about half a dozen at the end. And large numbers of undergrads doing it as a single honours degree and the rest of it. I mean, half the teachers in Scotland that now do what I do seem to come through at that time. And... Well, I got to the end of that degree, I felt that there was unfinished business. I thought there's a relationship to be examined here in a greater depth. And I had reasons to want to stay on. I'd met the current Mrs. Yezaitis by then. And I thought, well... but it was a genuine thing. I think I hate the parlance gap in the market, but I felt there was a real gap in the relation in discussing the relationship between media and religion. You probably felt the same way.
We met right at the time when that was, you know, we were sort of riding the crest of a wave around 1996. In Lancaster.
That's right. Yeah, and I remember Chris Arthur,
my supervisor,
giving a paper, and it was like the first time I thought, oh, there's other people out there thinking along similar lines. So that was really the aim, and I wasn't quite sure. It took me a wee while, and nobody quite knew what to do with it. I mean, thinking in academic terms, you know, the religious studies tended to just kind of take the media for granted, and the film and media studies tended to be enthralled to a very sort of materialist Marxist. But their understanding of religion was what I would call sub-Marx. They didn't really understand how pivotal religion was to Marx's thinking. That he kind of got religion, and he was one of the key figures in the development of sociology, religion as a discipline. So that was the angle I came in on. I wasn't really looking to do any sort of theological stuff, which had kind of definitely progressed, you know, sort of theology and religion was definitely a field, an emerging field, but I wanted to do something on sociology of film and religion. And at Stirling, there was the influence really came from, they were doing a lot on national identity, and it just ended up being, okay, American national identity, obviously religion is important, obviously film's important. It seemed to be a sort of, you know, the obvious place to go and try and start talking seriously about how these massive social forces kind of interact. And what I wanted to do, really, I think in my ambition, I mean, I'm not even sure it was a career ambition. I just thought there was room to open up a debate, which seems to me, you know, more than ever, actually, incredibly relevant to trying to understand what America's about. I could go on about it. Well, you don't want to be talking about my PhD.
Yeah, but I agree with what you say about escapism, because my sense was that there is, you know, a structure that films can certainly bring about. Mm. But, you know, even if I see the daft, you know, the films that get the one-star reviews, mm-hmm. For me, reading the reviews, and if ever I put my own say on social media, I don't just say this is the film that I saw. I'm saying, but Peter Bradshaw in The Guardian says this, or mm-hmm. and so for me, there's a dialogue. It's even a dialectic, really, because there's a sense that I will come from the film, and sometimes I genuinely don't know what to make of it. You need to process it, and then I'll read a review and I'll say, hang on a minute, no, that's going in a direction that I wouldn't have gone with that film. There are lots of sort of forces at work, I think, where critical analysis, irrespective of the quality of the film, mm-hmm. you know, has a bearing on the way in which you're able to apprehend it.
Well,
I think our journeys were very similar. It wasn't just mm-hmm. a case of let's go to throwaway entertainment. It was something that is, you know, meaning of life making.
Yeah, I mean, I tended to focus on movies that are actually avowedly about America. But following that sort of process, I was fascinated by the degree to which, for example, the films that are regarded as typically American, you know, were made by Catholic directors, for example, John Ford, Frank Capra, you know, who really had, what was the, if you like, why Why were the studios run almost to a man by Jews? I mean, it was Jewish men. What was going on? And of course, it's, you know, there's new media, new opportunities, new kids on the block. But also, you've got this incredible, the greatest single mass migration in human history between 1880 and 1920. And you've got to try and forge these tens of millions of people into some sort of collective unit. I'm not sure it could have happened without cinema. Because, of course, up until 1927, cinema was the last, I would call, universal medium. You didn't need to understand a single word of what anybody was saying. It was all through pictures. So Stalin liked Charlie Chaplin, didn't he? He was a big fan. Anybody could watch Charlie Chaplin and get it. So it was, I mean, for me, it's a really fascinating thing. What I struggled with was really that, you know, almost the orthodoxies and the various parent disciplines, interdisciplinary stuff is quite sort of, you know, talk a good game, but actually trying to forge a career thereafter is quite difficult because people don't really understand what you're talking about.
Do you use the medium of film with your school children?
A lot. I run a wee film club, which, you know, I'll usually start off, I'll probably get my this session started next week as we're talking, just the sort of middle of August. I usually throw in a blockbuster, I throw in a bit of left field stuff. My proudest moment was the kids in my school, and kids, you know, say, is it in black and white? Yeah, all of it. I think my proudest moment was showing The Kid by Charlie Chaplin, which is about an hour long, two lunchtimes. Most kids came back for the second part. The kids, for example, loved the original black and white version of All Quiet on the Western Front. I've introduced kids to things they wouldn't normally see, and I see that as my job. As you know, I mean, some of my kids, oh, you want to make education fun? I'm not a big fan of fun anyway. I think what you want to do, they can, these days, they can watch what the hell they like. What I have to do is make a case that I think you should. And this is why. And you know, you could. There's a movie. I don't know if you know it, called Pleasantville.
I know it very well.
Which I use with my second years to move into a discussion of identity and prejudice, because it's such a beautiful, gentle introduction to that. And it's only about halfway through the film you realise what the film's actually about. It's just, and I've watched it. I mean, I'll have watched it, I don't know, I suspect we're talking 30-odd times. And I still, one, think it's just a beautiful thing, but I get as much pleasure from watching the kids' reaction to it. And there's a beautiful moment in it as well where there's quite a, I guess what I call a racy scene.
Joan Allen.
I said, whatever you think you saw, you've got to understand it's all in your dirty little imaginations because you saw nothing.
When the tree suddenly goes on fire.
It's the equivalent of the shower scene in Psycho. It's so brilliantly done that everybody knows what's happening, but you've never seen anything.
You see, that film was very much misbilled because I went to the cinema to see it back in 1999 The other people in the, it was a Saturday morning in Swansea, and the other people in the cinema tended to be sort of young teenage, I think predominantly girls. Mm-hmm. And when I watched the film, I thought that seemed to be the wrong demographic, and I think there was something about the way that the film was billed that just didn't seem to sort of fit in the way that the Truman Show, which kind of covered similar.
Yeah, I use the Truman Show.
I think Pleasantville is far more subtle. The Truman Show is kind of a little bit too obvious. I mean, it got in there first. I think Pleasantville, there was no more room in that particular market, really. Point that I actually wrote an article on that one.
I think the Pleasantville experience for me is an interesting one because it's become an annual event in my school, and I've actually described it as a rite of passage because in the structure, whenever I've taught it, it comes at the end of a course on life after death, and I kind of started it because it came with the timing. Was there's a lot of report assessment marking, report writing, and I needed the time and 3 or 4 weeks. And I mean, and don't get me wrong, they do work around it. I get them to write stuff, I get them to think about what they're doing, and they have something to show in their jotters for it. But a lot of you can just, you know, leave it on for half an hour while you mark some work. But it led into what we did next, which is looking at identity and prejudice. And that's a unit which ends up with the Holocaust. And there's actually quite clear references to Pleasantville. But what I find, because teaching RMPS in a Scottish school, you see the kids, some kids you'll have taught for 4 or 5 years by the time they leave school. And you, sometimes you see them later on, and they'll come into the classroom and they'll see my DVD of Pleasantville. Lying about, oh, Pleasantville, that's such a great film. And there's an element, I'm sort of almost creating a nostalgia. And I explain to them, for example, the references, so when they're talking about the big beds, well, it's the code, isn't it? The code of Legion of Decency code, that you weren't allowed to show men and women on the same bed up until, what, the mid-60s, 66, I think the code started really falling apart. Going back to the question, I use film quite a lot. There's certain films, you know, if anybody's interested, they can get in touch, or things I'd recommend. One of my favourites is Son of Rambo. I don't know if you know that one. It's bootleg video, and it's set in the 1980s, before the age of mobile phones, when pirating videos, you know, people would literally take a camera into the cinema. And it's about a friendship between two boys, one who from a very strict religious background, the other one a bit of a tearaway. But what's interesting, I started showing it as a free period, and gradually the kids put down their phones and actually watched it, because in some ways the universals of childhood, friendship, school, these kinds of things, that's what that film is really really about. And I think that's the beauty of trying to get a proper story across. I never show a film just in bits. If I start showing a film, they watch the whole film, it'll be over 3 or 4 lessons. Kind of makes my lesson planning quite easy. But at the same time, I can't stress enough how important I think actual narrative is for kids, because I think if anything there's a kind of real lack of it in kids' lives these days. The fragmented, you know, 2-minute YouTube videos and all that, I like to try and get a story across. So
so it's very clear what sort of pattern there has been throughout your life in terms of how you're assimilating material but then presenting it with energy and sort of saying, you know, you have to watch and hold, you can't sort of cut corners. And it sounds as though your university, your wish to do a humanities degree in which there were lots of books to read, it was part of that trajectory, that it was a case of saying, okay, I need to familiarise myself with the source material in order then to be able to move on to do whatever then, you know, the consequences of that might be.
It's strange enough, there was quite a disappointment to me, I think, if I'm being really, really honest. I think it was quite a disappointment to me that essentially I couldn't really get my career started in higher education, teaching and researching in the way I wanted to. Now, there were a lot of things going on, but part of it was the short-term contract and families a bit more demanding. You've got a mortgage. You can't be, you know, there's a strain that comes from thinking, well, what am I doing for the next 4 months or whatever. And so I took the leap to go into secondary education, partly because I really, really enjoyed teaching in higher education, sadly neglected aspect of the process, actually engaging with students and the films you get to teach when I was doing the film stuff. You know, you could do the Tarantino stuff, you know, grown-up stuff. But the teaching I loved, and so I moved in there. But when I got myself established as a teacher in schools, I thought, well, this actually makes sense of my life hitherto. because I mean, I've mentioned it, but I mean, I've also had a sort of musical career, and if you like the rock and roll lifestyle, I've done stuff that the kids, you know, going on tour with a band or whatever. A lot of the kids kind of think that would be great, and I still get to see you in a band. Actually, I'm in two, but the situations that you're in and the kind of problems you have to deal with and the various things you have to deal with leading a kind of quite a sort of portfolio life, I should say, rather than just career, is perfect for a teacher, because what kids want in school, my view, more than any academic stuff, is trying to get some sense of how does the world work, because that's where we're going. And I sometimes think that teachers don't recognize that. I've talked to lots of kids who, for example, even when they're talking about, and sometimes it's real nuts and bolts stuff, PSE, Personal Social Education in Scotland, they'll talk about, first year there'll be stuff on substance, alcohol, that stuff, second, third. And I've had literally 40 years ago, sir, we know drugs are bad, but I don't know how to open a bank account. And it's that sort of nuts and bolts stuff. But at the same time, you've got, you know, that's what teachers can do. You're in a position to, if you like, impart experience. And it's somebody that kids will reject what their parents tell them. Somebody else at school, if you can establish some sort of credibility and authority with them, you can maybe drop a few hints as to what's waiting for them down the road. And
I can imagine that they really respect you, because you've clearly lived a life where, you know, you're in a band. I think in a way that you show what you can achieve through hard work, but at the same time you have also
I don't know about the hard work. It's strange. The older I get, the more I think about this. I have a bit of a problem with the word deserve. Because I don't believe it hangs true. If you look at society, who's grown richer? It's not people that deserve it. And so in school, it's strange. I do address it quite directly sometimes. I said, when we're talking about myth, you know, I said, we're all subject to myth. The myth in this school is that you work hard, you get your qualifications, you get a good job at the end of it. Well, that would be true for some of you, but not for all of you. It's not going to work out that way. And sometimes people get much more than they deserve, and other times people get much less than they deserve. And we've just had our results back, and we pore over them. I can't believe this person got an A, and I can't believe this person didn't pass. You know, there's those kinds of moments in a school. But I think that, you know, what you can impart, I think, is much more important than necessarily just the, you know, work hard, is actually resilience. But, you know, you'll get over it, it will pass, however bad it is now, keep it together. And I mean, you know, I see a lot of really, you know, there's a lot of, you know, yeah, it's become a cliche to talk about a mental health crisis in our society, but it certainly is with young people, that it must be quite hard trying to chart a course that, if you're remotely intelligent and informed, you're thinking, well, what's coming down the road at us? You know, climate change, real problems getting jobs. I may never be able to buy my own house. You know, those kinds of things. And, you know, my view is that sort of, if you like, my generation, I'll say this to the kids, have really messed things up for young people. There's always provided, wasn't me personally, you know, but I think, you know, they need to address that. But I guess the other thing is, you know, I also think sometimes there's no harm in just kind of staring out of a window, or even just watching a movie for half an hour. There was a eye-opening moment for me. There was a series, it was a week on books, I think, on BBC Two Book Week ages ago. And there was a programme that sort of just, my curiosity got the better of me. It was a programme about books for kids that are under two. And I thought, what could that possibly be about? Kids can't read. What's that about? All right, bedtime stories. How can they make an hour programme? Actually, it was really, really fascinating. And there was one really key thing that I took, and this taps into all sorts of theories of reception and audience, quite, you know, academic stuff, but it was like, when a child is, you know, say 18 months old, the world is changing for them. They're learning so much, so quickly. Things happen so quickly, and they've yet to make sense of what's happening. They don't have a story or a myth. They can barely talk. They can barely make sense. They're starting to communicate. Sitting down with a book and a picture in front of them and somebody that they love reading it to them is possibly the one moment in the day when they can actually take stock of things and look at things at their own pace, take control of a situation, and hence the repetition. Kids love the same story over and over again, and it's because it's the familiarity, they're understanding who they are. So for me, you know, for example, there's an element of that, of occasionally in the lesson, you know, there's content, it'll do the usual, you know, it's the, I don't want to give the impression that kids don't work, you know, I get pretty good, damn good exam results, but I also occasionally, let's goof off for a bit. You know, we don't have to work so hard. I think our society is actually obsessed with hard work to a point where it's damaging us now, that you get ahead. You know, for example, in my profession, you know, promotion is all about how you're being seen to be doing stuff, which usually involves creating work for other people, actually. You know, not to put too fine a point on it, if any of my colleagues are listening. And actually, you know, we don't need more stuff. We don't need to be making more. We maybe need to be spending more time doing the things that we love and doing the things that reconnect us with, if you like, our story. It's quite interesting after the sort of academic career and getting established in teaching. I went back to playing music regularly. And it's as integral to me. It's definitely not an earner. Let's put it that way. It's definitely not an earner, but it's something. To give an example, one of my bands. Both of them are real labours of love. But we recently played up at Belladrum. Still got the band on here. We got paid £50 for the gig. Now, we shelled out more than that for two of us just staying in an Airbnb for a couple of nights. But it's, you know, one, it was a lot of fun, and it's something you're compelled to do. And I've often felt that, you know, that's how you judge an artist. Do they need to be doing what they're doing? And actually, even some of the most successful artists, you know, I don't know, you're thinking of great painters like, I don't know, Francis Bacon, whatever, upset workaholics. They had to do what they were doing, and you know, sometimes you have, there's things that we all have to do to stay kind of sane.
But often there's a difference, isn't there, between an inner drive, something that you know you have to do, and I have some of those traits. I mean, these interviews to an extent, it's a passion that I have. I want to do this. But if somebody said you have to go around and interview people, I'd think, hang on, you're putting on a certain, you know, an imposition, and I think that. That's where teaching can come in, that you can actually say, because I mean, I remember being at school where RE was compulsory. It was a church school, but there was and they refused to study. It was more that they knew it was a waste of time subject, and therefore they would mess around at the back. The teacher would go mad with them, and they used to play it up in a subject like maths or physics. It was a different kettle of fish because they thought, this is a serious subject, but we want to be here, and that's interesting. So, but a really good teacher can sort of say, you know, can find a way of connecting with the class.
Well, I think it's one thing to go with an agenda. You're going to learn this. Actually, the beauty of my subject, although it's actually the only subject that's prescribed by law in Scotland, it has to be taught. And again, it's a bit of a, like the problem of the established church, and no one really wants to go to it. But I was lucky enough to come into teaching that at a time when it was being transformed by, actually, probably visionaries isn't too strong a word for it, people who saw the possibilities of a subject. I mean, I think there's still maybe a problem with what it's called. I would definitely like to be moving towards something along the cultural studies thing, a wider remit. But actually, religion, morality, philosophy, well, kind of what else is there, if you like? And we can talk about anything. So kids, you know, after if they've spent 4 years with me, will have, you know, been introduced to, you know, some of the classic stories from the Bible. They will have a smattering of understanding of Hinduism. And if they did certificate, they'll know a lot about Hinduism. They'll have done stuff on child poverty. They'll have watched Pleasantville, or, you know, every single one of them that I have in second year. They will understand the relationship between, well, hopefully understand, I mean, the relationship between belief and action, and hopefully be starting to work things out for themselves. Really, that's all ultimately it's like, oh yeah, I really like this. There's topics that you can't, you know, as a teacher, there's a lot of repetition, more so than in higher education, I think, that you do something. But even teaching Genesis 1, okay, each year a kid will say something different or come at an angle, or I'll find a new way into a text that has been read by, you know, I mean, literally countless numbers of people, and find a new way into a text, a new way of looking at it, discussing it, or whatever. And that's just that's great. And you know, Genesis 1 kind of we do in first year, we also do it in higher, you know, those kind of texts, you know, they're just, you know, they've got, and what you want to do is try and get across to go why it still matters. You know, what you think of it. You know, I don't care what you think of it, but it's important to have a viewpoint.
Mm. And another one, you've made me think of something about 15 years ago where I used the same text to two different classes on the same day, mm-hmm. and got two very different responses.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It didn't go the way I expected it to, that it was the first years who engaged more than the second and third years.
All right, yeah. People come with things from different angles. You notice, I mean, you get, I mean, for, you know, even as a teacher, you know, who's in the class, time of day, you know, whether you're in it. I mean, you know, one of the things we're teaching is, you know, that sort of you're enjoying doing an interview, but if you had to do it, and sometimes you go in front a class that you've really no interest in doing it because your mind is elsewhere, or you're not feeling it, or you know, actually most of the class would be taken up with dealing with discipline issues, and you don't get there, and you know there's kids in the class that really want to engage with what you're doing, but a lot of the time you're battling. You know, it's a noble profession, teaching, a bit like soldiering.
Yeah, well, just a couple of questions to round off,
okay.
Because you brought up the subject of nostalgia earlier, but I was thinking, can you be nostalgic, do you think, about negative experiences? Because in your, you know, we're talking about challenge. You mentioned deserve, and how sometimes, you know, whether you deserve it. I mean, this is typical for like film noir territory, isn't it? You know, and what is that film about? Deserve? It's got nothing to do with it. That's the last line of. Something very profound. I'll think about it. But would you say then that whole sense of, you know, sometimes you can reflect on something and there was a challenge, but it's what you did, the experience of going through something that might be catastrophic. We started by looking at the Second World War, but a sense in which that could be, the narrative can then be one of triumphing over adversity.
We're almost at the R word, aren't we?
Because yes. When I say the R word, I think redemption.
Yeah, exactly. I think so. I mean, I think of some of the negative experiences that I've had. Again, it's sort of, I have a temper. It's quite explosive, but it dies down, and I'm quite a forgiving person, which means I can repair relationships. But I have, what that means is sometimes I will literally, can I swear? I'll say, fuck it. I'm not doing that anymore. And literally, I've walked out on jobs. When I was a younger man, you're prone to, you know, when you've got a mortgage, it's much tougher to do that. But later on, and I've done it in sort of musical situations or whatever. And then later on, you realize, you kind of think, okay, where did it go wrong? And I think this goes back to, you know, what I think is really important is resilience, is like taking responsibility for your own actions in this sometimes. I think it's a topic that we don't talk about enough as a society, because I think we're really at a bit of a tipping point in terms of we really need to take responsibility for our actions, yeah. Not least because of overconsumption of natural resources, things like that. But also in terms of our relationships, we're so, you know, the rise of Trump, blame someone else. Farage, blame someone else. It's Johnny Foreigner.
And call it fake news.
And it's never your fault. And actually, I think the kind of modern nobility, if you like, being noble now is facing up to the really difficult time that I think we're moving into as a species. I don't say as a planet, because it's going to be difficult. It's going to be tough for other species. We've made it tough for some of them. But I also think if you can learn, okay, where did things go wrong here? Whether it's in a interpersonal relationship, or I mean, I have to do it as a, you know, one of the things about teaching, there's a lot of emphasis on reflective practitioner. You know, where sometimes you know, a lesson really falls apart, and sometimes you've run the same lesson four times and it's the last one that's a disaster. You know, in school you have that in school, what was going on there? And in the end you have to go, well actually I should have done this, or I just got it wrong. Sometimes a lesson doesn't even fly from the start and you're going, you know, like rejig it. So I think that's, yeah, whether that's nostalgia, I think nostalgia comes from the, if you like, the breakthrough you make in your own thinking. You know, if you're talking about lifelong learning, and I think both you and I are, the nature of the professions that we've chosen to pursue, that's almost what you want, the Sartori, the kick in the head, the, oh, I get it. Now I understand what that was about. And then move on. So I guess that's a sort of, you know, there's an element of nostalgia there. But I think the thing is, you can't, I think nostalgia as a term always worries me, that you're seeking to dwell in the past because the present is too painful. And the past seems more attractive, but you can never go there, you know. What's that? There's a line that Jackson Brown wrote about, sometimes it would be easier to change the past, talking about what's going on in a relationship. But that's exactly what you have to try and do. You can't change the past. You can find another different way of looking at it.
You can change the perspectives on it, yes.
And understanding it. And I guess that's what history is, isn't it? That you're forever debating. That's why, you know, in my doctorate I went back and looked at a film that had been made, you know 90 years previously, because I felt there was something new to say about it, something that had been missed that I still think speaks to now, you know the kind of the rise of America seen as a victim. So yeah, I think there's a
What about the sense of fulfilling the dreams that we have? Because sometimes we have realistic dreams, sometimes we have fanciful dreams, and actually sometimes the fanciful dreams can be just as real. I mean, actually one thing that I was just thinking of a moment ago was this concept of the myth of the supernatural redeemer, the sense of somebody else coming in and taking away your problems. It's like, we can't sort it out ourselves, and that's what we have to avoid. But would you say that, do you still entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life? Was there a sense that you thought once that there was a particular avenue you wanted to explore, a trajectory that you were on? Or is it a case of...
Continually, actually. I mean, I think you think about that all the time, but part of that, you think, if I've never met this person, say my wife, I wouldn't have these children. And I think, you know, adulthood is about accepting compromise, I suppose. This maybe sounds a bit sort of wishy-washy, but understanding that, you know, like, you know, I'm quoting from the Rolling Stones, sometimes you get what you need. You can't always get what you want. And you know, that the compulsion, you know, I feel that actually if you'd said to me, well, I'm not sure what I would have made of my life now if you'd offered it to me as it is when I was, say, mid-20s or something, I might have been surprised that was still around. I think one of the things is learning to appreciate what you've got, and the good things is really important, because it's easy to build up resentment, you know, oh, somebody else got that promotion, somebody else, you know, got that post. I'll end with a story. It's got a bit of a dark ending to this story. When I was trying to get myself established in my academic career, I'd been doing a short-term post, and a permanent post came up in the department at Stirling, and I was encouraged to apply for it. And a good friend of mine, I'm not going to mention him by name, but a good friend of mine, who I taught as an undergrad, applied for it. And as soon as he said he was applying for it, and I knew what he was doing, he had a really interesting research interest, and I thought he'll get the job, because it would be daft not to give him the job. He is a better fit for the department and what they do, and all the rest. And he duly got the job. I was disappointed. I thought I gave a decent interview and all the rest of it. But it wasn't a surprise. I was, disappointed is putting it mildly, but I wasn't surprised. I congratulated him. I mean, he was a really good friend. We spent quite a lot of time together. And we kept in touch. I actually worked with him on a short-term contract, delivering one of the courses, and he was an inspiring teacher and all the rest of it. And then after I sort of jumped sectors, if you like, I ran into him recently. I'll tell you what happened. And he was telling me about his job, and I think you recognise this. Of course, his job's been overtaken by admin. This really inspiring, brilliant teacher with a real insight has been taken over by admin. Anyway, we made plans. Oh, really needs to go for a curry really soon. Catch you soon. Anyway, three weeks later, he killed himself. So, you kind of, you don't know how, you know, if I'd been put in that situation, how would I have gone? I mean, is it, you know, but it was a really, he was a lovely, lovely guy. And there would have been other things going on. But, you know, it's also a reminder, in the same way that, you know, funerals are for the living. You know, it's absolutely a reminder, you know, gather ye rosebuds and all that. Mm. And I think that sense of using things to remind yourself of, you know, things could be other than they are. You know, I've generally been blessed with pretty good mental health. I've been blessed with pretty good physical health. You know, I know plenty of people who are hitting 60 who've spent a lot of time in and out of hospital, recently went to the funeral of a colleague. I haven't suffered that many major bereavements in my lifetime, let alone recently, you know, so that you've just got to appreciate things while you've got them, because all you've got is what you've got right now anyway. There's nothing promised. So, I mean, there's an element that you can look back, and instead of, you know, look around you right now. Mm. And, you know, I'm in an incredibly fortunate position. And I'm somebody who can moan for Britain about what's going on in Scottish education or politics, or, you know, there's no good bands anymore, or whatever it is. But actually, when it comes down to it, I think you just need to sort of punch yourself in the head, literally, sometimes, and remind yourself, actually, you are lucky. Because not every, I know people in far more difficult situations than me right now.
But it sounds like you've also answered what was going to be my last question, which was whether you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
A little bit of both. I think they talk about, if you keep looking back, you get depressed. If you keep looking, if you're worried about the future, you get anxious. And increasingly, I think there's I'm moving house in a matter of days. I'm quite excited about that, and I'm quite excited about this new phase of my future. But what I try and do is stay in the present, really, because that's all you really kind of can do. So no matter how worrying things get, all you can do is what's in front of you. You've got, you know, sometimes it's one thing worrying about, I don't know, the end of the world or whatever, but hey, I've got a class in front of me and those kids need my full attention, and you get on with it.
Yeah, I'm so glad we've caught up again. Chris, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.